The ideal, we know it's unattainable, but the ideal would have been you take an unknown quantum state, you have some pure state that's the reference state that you're going to write your clone onto, some initial pure state of the machine, and the ideal is to make a pure state, leave the pure state alone, make a second pure state that's a faithful copy of it, and some machine state that depends on psi and itself is also pure. And we saw that linearity, this one-line argument really here, linearity is enough to exclude that possibility. We then looked at variations on cloning. So one possibility was state discrimination, just for two non-orthogonal states. Linearity doesn't exclude that, but unitarity does. And then another natural possibility, given the impossibility of perfect no-cloning, another natural question is, what about approximate quantum cloning? How close can we get to perfect quantum cloning? So what I guess it's important to distinguish here between the effective operation of the machine, which I've written out here. You have an input, you have your reference state, you get out, in the case we're looking at, two qubit states, and you're really interested in the reduced density matrices there. And what's underlying that? Psi, R0, M. Well, in general now, since we've accepted the possibility that we're not going to get perfect cloning, and we're looking at potentially mixed state outputs here, in general, we have the possibility of some trebly entangled state that combines all three of these. So this is a qubit. This is a qubit. Who knows at this stage what size the machine is? Let's assume it's finite dimensional. So this is some entangled state. We should allow the possibility this is some entangled state of two qubits and d-dimensional machine state. But we can, so this lives in H, what should we call these? H1 tensor, H2 tensor, H machine. And we're interested in the outputs rho 1, which is going to be given by tracing over both the other two factors, so H2 tensor H machine of psi prime, and rho 2, which is given by tracing over the first and third factors of psi prime. That, can people read that? Maybe I can flip it up. So that's the most general possibility that we could have for our approximate cloning machine. And then we want to understand how well or how badly we're approximating to perfect cloning. One obvious test of that is if you're given rho 1, does it look like psi to you? Does it look like psi to you in the sense that if you measure projector onto psi, what's the probability? You get it. The outcome corresponding to the eigenvalue 1. In other words, the answer, yes, this was psi. Well, what is that probability? It's just trace of, I call this P psi. The probability is trace of P psi rho 1. And another way of writing that is just the inner product of psi with rho 1 with psi. Can people see that? Yeah. Okay. So for this particular question, where we're asking how close is a potentially mixed state to a particular pure state, This seems like a very natural measure, indeed, of how well we've succeeded. The only way that we can get fidelity 1 is if rho 1 actually equals the pure state psi. You can easily check that. And in terms of the geometry in the Bloch sphere, the closer rho 1 is to the state psi, the closer the fidelity is to 1. If you look at the uniformly mixed state, that's got fidelity half. If you look at the orthogonal state, the case we've spectacularly failed, that's got fidelity 0. So let's use that as our measure of closeness. Remember, here's the full picture. Here's the bits we're really going to focus on, these reduced density matrices. So the question we're asking is, can we approximate cloning? Can we get these fidelities to be greater than or equal to 1 minus epsilon? And the question I left you with last time was, can in fact we do this for any epsilon greater than 0? Can we get arbitrarily good approximate cloning? We already discussed this a little bit at the end of last time, but did people come up with a conclusive answer? Yes or no? Yes. Who says yes? One yes. Who says no? 4 or 5 no's. The rest are just hedging your bets a little bit.
Well, it depends on epsilon.
Sorry? Depends on epsilon.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Something like 1/2, that's possible.
Well, okay, so let's start with that. How do you know that's possible? Okay. look, here's one thing. If you only want epsilon equals 1/2, the uniformly mixed state has fidelity 1/2. So you could just throw away the original state, make states whose reduced density matrices are the uniformly mixed state, and you've got that. So certainly for some epsilon, I mean, even for epsilon equals 1, any state at all will work. For some epsilons, you can do it. I guess the question we were trying to address last time, though, is it for any epsilon greater than 0, for arbitrarily small epsilon, can you do it? So you said no. You said yes. Was this the argument that you gave at the end of last time?
You have an operator which, based on what you measure the first ket to be, you have an evolution operator. So you have the two coupled, you kind of like couple the evolution of this unitary operator so that you can evolve the other state into the state nearby what you want, and then you should, when you take the inner product of that evolved state with the state you want, I would think that you could get that to be a non-zero overlap. So
non-zero overlap.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess what you're looking for here is much better than that. We're looking for an overlap arbitrarily close to one.
I think you could get it pretty good. That's my intuition.
Pretty good or arbitrarily close to one? Because they're still two different things.
I guess pretty arbitrarily close to one.
Okay. I take it from the way you phrased this, you haven't actually done this calculation. It's an intuition. So it's something you could do. You could test. I didn't quite get the first bit as well. You measure the input qubit.
So it's kind of like you have a projection operator, and then based on the projection, you have a unitary evolution for the second state.
Yeah, but you've got to choose some measurement for the input qubit, I guess.
Wait, what?
You've got to choose what measurement you're going to carry out on the input qubit. Presumably, because your input is the state psi, but of course you don't know what it is. So you've got to pick a measurement.
Right. So you have a projection on psi, and then times that psi, you have something that's supposed to evolve things. I guess what you're expecting into psi.
Okay. So there's an intuition there about combining, carrying out a projection and unitary evolution, and seeing how close you can get to 1, let's put it that way at least. Who said no? Remind me, please. Who said no and has an argument for no? Okay. You don't have an argument. Anybody got an argument? Yeah. Sorry, the... You've only seen it done for less fidelity. Okay. So that's sort of an empirical argument. Somebody would have told you if you could do it for fidelity close to one. Any stronger?
Even if we could do practically good learning, so then we could superluminal mistake.
Ah. So we saw if you get.
That's a good argument, I guess. But
well, is it or isn't it? I don't know. So I mean, we already saw if you got fidelity equal one, that you would have superluminal signaling. We don't believe you can have superluminal signaling, so that's an argument against f equals one. Can we extend that to fidelity is one minus epsilon for small epsilon?
Yes, we can.
Carry on. Okay. So how? Tell me.
For example, I missed the class, but what I have in mind is then you film the state several times, and then you have a billion of that in the state, for example. And then you choose, for example, if I want to say yes to him, I would measure the spin direction in the z-axis and all of them. And if I want to say no, I would measure it in the x-axis or something like that.
So this is what we discussed for the case f equals one last time, indeed.
Okay.
Yeah.
The results in what the experiment is, where the guy at the other end would measure was something like all of them in one direction, and the other one was something like half of them in one state and half of them in the other state. Okay. Well, if you change it a little. Very little. Then what would you get? It's something like almost all of them in one direction. Then it means yes, and almost all of them in.
Good. Thank you. Okay.
One direction, then that means no.
I think that's right. And we can spell it out. But did you have another comment or thought or tangential
problems?
So. Okay.
Check it's possible to have not 1 minus epsilon, but epsilon, or something very small but close to zero. Mm-hmm. Could you copy something, to the precision of a small epsilon? And if you could, which I think randomly, you could choose a state that would fit into this. So I don't see any restriction, any physical quantity in the problem the way it's posed that would stop you from continuing this process from small epsilon to something very close to one. So whenever you manage to show that you can clone something with very very small precision, but precision of that's non-zero,
yeah.
And that would allow you to somehow continue this analysis of the situation to something.
I can't tell whether this is an argument for yes or no, because
there's an argument for yes very close to one minus.
You must be able to get very. The argument is supposed to be telling us you must be able to get arbitrarily close to one, because you can't see any physical constants in the picture. Basically, if there's some non-zero epsilon that's a cutoff, it ought to be some multiple of h bar or c or something, but we don't have any such constants in the picture. That's an interesting argument. Let me carry on. Okay. Thanks for all of those.
I have a question.
Okay.
Is there any difference between interacting measurements and non-interacting measurements?
Interacting and non-interacting.
Yeah, we already have something about non-interacting measurements.
Interaction-free.
Yeah.
You went through a long discussion of interaction-free measurements and the bomb.
Yeah.
And so.
That's it.
So I guess here we're really assuming that we. Can describe all of this by some unitary evolution in the end. And that would be true whether or not we have a sort of standard projective measurement process or an interaction-free measurement process. So the idea is really just to postpone the point when we decide that the measurement's taken place until after the machine's finished working. That's at least one way of looking at that. Okay, so I agree with your no signaling argument. We already agreed that these two density matrices that you would be able to create if you could perfectly clone are distinguishable. They're actually different things. So what should I call those? Let's call them sigma 1. Can I push this up? Yeah. Sigma 1 is the first one, the half up, plus down, and sigma 2 is the same thing, but with left and right instead of up and down. So right, plus left. Oops, left. So, if you start with a singlet state, and you're able to clone one of the qubits, then somebody who controls the other qubit can effectively give you either sigma 1 or sigma 2, depending whether they carry out a measurement in this of sigma z or sigma x. And we agreed last time that sigma 1 and sigma 2 are definitely different density matrices. I guess the argument we used last time was, suppose you carry out a measurement of sigma z on both qubits. If you have sigma 1 in your hand, then you will either get up twice or down twice. That's it. On the other hand, if you have sigma 2 in your hand, you could get up twice, you could get down twice, but you could also get up once and down once when you're measuring sigma z. So they give you different probabilities for the outcomes. In particular, sigma 2 gives you a non-zero probability for getting the outcome up once and down once. Therefore, they must be different density matrices. So now we have a way of getting arbitrarily close to perfect cloning. It's not going to give you quite sigma 1 and sigma 2, but it's going to give you density matrices arbitrarily close to those. So what should we call this? Let me break this down. So your approximate cloner produces sigma 1 epsilon, which is approximately sigma 1, and sigma 2 epsilon, which is approximately sigma 2. And since these are definitely separated by a finite distance, it must be the case that for sufficiently small epsilon, it's also true that sigma 1 epsilon is not equal to sigma 2 epsilon. So for a small epsilon. Remember, that epsilon equals 0, sigma 1 epsilon equals sigma 1. It's order epsilon away from it. So these two things for sufficiently small epsilon must be different. Therefore, they must also be distinguishable by some measurements. In fact, the same trick will work. We can just measure sigma z, and we'll see that the distribution of outcomes is different in the epsilon approximation to this case from the epsilon approximation to this case. As if epsilon is small, the probability of getting one up and one down is going to be very small. In this case, it's going to be order epsilon. But it's going to be close to a half plus of order epsilon in this case. So the argument again, the superluminal signaling argument, tells us not just that we can't perfectly clone, but we can't get arbitrarily close to perfect cloning. So then we're, well, then we're left with a natural question, I guess. We can't do perfect cloning. We can't do arbitrarily close to perfect cloning. What can we do? Can we achieve anything that you could sensibly call some sort of even rather dirty approximate cloning? Can we get produce density matrices rho 1 and rho 2 with fidelity eta for any eta greater than 0, for any eta greater than 1/2? Well, actually, you've already thrown out some ideas that would achieve at least eta equals 1/2. I mean, just replacing psi, just throwing away psi and making two random states will give us eta equals 1/2. So eta equals 1/2 isn't really impressive. Eta between 1/2 and 0 is distinctly unimpressive. I guess the first natural question is, can we achieve eta greater than 1/2? Does anybody have any suggestions, any ideas for how we... It doesn't have to be a very good scheme, but it's any way of starting to think about approximate cloning. You're given an input state psi, you've got to make two states. Yep?
Yeah, in my opinion, it should depend on the state the system is. So our cloning system should be different effective according to the state in which should be cloned. So because we don't know the state we want to clone, we have to decide for which states our cloning machine should be very good, and probably for other ones very bad, because usually we know that we can clone states which are in the direction of our measurement. So for example, in a two-state system we can clone pure states, but we won't be able to clone states which are arbitrarily close to each other, or in a way that we won't be able to distinguish between them in a proper way. So I would say that this mu should be more or less a kind of distribution dependent on the state we want to clone. And we cannot give an upper boundary, which is true for all states.
Okay, so let's take an example you sort of gave there. We could just decide we're going to measure sigma z. And if the input is, and we're going to get either up, spin up or spin down as the output. And the idea, do I understand right? The idea is just you're going to make two copies of the output. So whatever it is. So you either make spin up, or spin down.
Is that because
we agreed on that. Yeah. So this, as we agreed yesterday.
Yeah.
If you know that the input state is spin up or spin down, this is perfect cloning. So this gives fidelity 1 for input up or down. And it gives fidelity 1/2 for input, say right or left, among other states. In other words, we have a state-dependent fidelity. Okay, so that's, thanks for that. Yeah, that's certainly a constructive thought in the direction of trying to find some sort of approximate cloning. This is approximate in a slightly different sense from the one that I raised. It works very well for some states. It works pretty poorly for other states. Do we have to have state-dependent fidelities? Do we have to accept that it, in particular, do we have to accept that we're not going to get better than a random output for some states. Is there a way, could we make this scheme? At the moment, this scheme is sort of broken our symmetry. We've picked a particular basis, the Z basis, and we're going to measure in that basis. Could we restore that symmetry in this scheme? Yep.
Can we pick a random axis?
Yeah, we could. Thank you. One thing we can do is just decide each time we're going to choose a random axis. We're going to carry out a measurement about that axis, and then we're going to play this game. So whatever the let's call this now up for the axis B and down for the axis B. We're going to measure in axis B. We'll either get up B or down B, and then we're going to make two copies of the output. So here's our input state. The question now is averaging over our axis choices. How effective is this as cloning? We don't know the input. We choose a random output. We make two copies, plus B twice or minus B twice. What's the probability of getting plus B? Well, we can work that out. It just depends on the angle between the unknown A and the axis B. And one simple way of writing it is it's half 1 plus A dot B. And similarly, the probability of minus B is half 1 minus A dot B. This is just our cos theta, the angle between them, written another way. How well does that clone? Well, if we look at our measure of fidelity, that's trace of, this is effectively the density matrix corresponding to the input state psi. So this is psi. This is the possible output state, 1 plus b dot sigma or 1 minus b dot sigma. What are those fidelities? Well, you just need to work out this trace. And remember that the identity matrix has trace 2, the Pauli matrices have trace 0. But we could pick up another term from contributions to the energy that we get when we multiply, for instance, sigma 1 by sigma 1. So we get an A, we get delta ij times the identity from sigma I dot sigma j, so we'll get an A dot B term as well. And we end up with fidelities of half 1 plus A dot B and half 1 minus A dot B for the two possible outputs. And the probability of the output is actually in this case, exactly the same as the fidelity. Doesn't need to be in general, but in this calculation, that's how it works out. So if we look at the average fidelity over all possible choices of the axis, we just need to integrate over the sphere or for all possible vectors B on the sphere of the probability of one output times its fidelity plus the probability of the other one times its fidelity. And because these expressions are simple and the fidelities and probabilities are both equal, that gives us a rather simple expression, which indeed gets even simpler because the linear terms drop away. And you end up, after a little bit of integration, with the answer 2/3.
Question?
Yeah.
So do we have to measure enough arbitrary or randomly chosen direction? If we assume that the state we want to clone is arbitrary in our two-dimensional Hilbert space, and then we calculate the fidelity if we choose a fixed axis, shouldn't we get the same result? Because
we will get
the advantage of this method is it does not depend on the state. Then we don't have this dependency, but
we would,
it shouldn't be matter if we rotate our measurement device or the distribution of the states in the Hilbert space.
Right. I mean, the difference is in one case, the average fidelity will be the same in both cases.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But in one case, there's an asymmetry in your cloning process. It works very well for particular choices of states and very badly for others. And here we've symmetrized. It works equally well or equally badly for all possible states.
That's the only advantage of this method.
That's the only advantage. And whether it's an advantage or not is debatable. But it might depend on
the
context. But if you want to guarantee that on average, whatever the input state is, you're going to get fidelity at least 2/3, you need this method rather than the previous one you described. Whatever the input state.
So yours
will work better for some and worse for others.
On our knowledge of the system, which method we should prefer?
If we know for sure that the system is either spin up or spin down, it's all trivial. But if we had some biased information, if we know that it's likelier to be sort of somewhere close to spin up or somewhere close to spin down, then we should certainly, we better write out a figure of merit. But most likely we should measure in the sigma z basis and use the first version of the scheme. Certainly our average fidelity will be higher if we do that. Yeah. You looked happy and now you look puzzled. Are you? No? No, you're happy.
I'm okay.
Question?
So, when you make two copies of the outcome state, do you just assume the nerve cloning theorem doesn't apply then to those?
No. You carry out a measurement and you get a definite outcome.
Uh-huh.
If you know what the state is in your hand,
yeah,
you can make as many copies as you like
of
it. The nerve cloning theorem applies to an unknown state, but here we actually have a classical information. We have the measurement outcome, so we don't have to worry about the nerve cloning theorem. There's actually another, maybe even more brain dead. Sorry, I didn't mean to be rude about these things, but possibly more brain but dead way of cloning. You could just take your initial state and take a random state. So here's the initial state. Just choose any random qubit. And if you want to be loose, just flip a coin and you decide whether to swap them or not. If you want to be a bit more precise, I guess the thing we want to prepare is this superposition of equally weighted superposition of states, the initial state first and your random state second, plus the other way around. So if you like, we have a one qubit cloning machine here that's playing a role of the coin, and you're preparing machine state, output state one, output state two, superposed, so that you either have your initial states, which you haven't done anything to, being output as the first, or it being output as the second. So to speak, you have equal weights in superposition of that. So if you do that and look at these reduced density matrices, well, you have an equal, in the first case, you have an equal mixture of psi and psi prime. And in the second case, the states are the other way around. But again, you have an equal mixture of psi and psi prime. So indeed, we've achieved rho 1 equals rho 2. And if you look at the average fidelity here, well, psi's got fidelity 1 with itself, of course, and it's got fidelity 1/2 with a random state. And so we've actually got an average fidelity for each of them of 3/4, which, although this looks like a less sophisticated thing to do, we didn't extract any information from psi at all, we didn't carry out any measurement, actually gives us a higher value of fidelity. Remember, we got 2/3 last time. So we seem to be closing in on trying to find some bound on the fidelity. 1 isn't possible, 1 minus epsilon for small epsilon isn't possible. We now see 3/4 is possible. And it would be nice to get some precise result on what exactly is the maximum possible. So we could approach this two ways. You could try out the schemes for cloning and see how high you can proceed to And you could try refining the arguments, the no signaling argument, for instance, and see if you can get a better bound on the maximum possible value of eta. And ideally, what we hope will happen, and what indeed turns out to work, is that those two both give the same number. We get a bound, it'll turn out to be 5.6, and we can find a scheme that achieves that bound, or 5.6. Okay, so the argument I want to give now is trying to do the first of it, trying to refine our bound on eta, get it as low as possible, using really nothing, essentially nothing but the no signaling principle. And this goes back to a very nice paper by Nicolas Gisin in the late 1990s. So we've been focusing throughout on the case of qubits, so let's stick with that case. We have an input qubit, we have our reference state, again we have the reduced density matrices. We're going to be interested in, as we have been so far, in the symmetric case where these two fidelities are the same. And let me just comment, if we have a machine that doesn't do that, we can always make it into one that does do that just by randomizing the outputs, just by using this trick of superposing the mixture of unpermuted and permuted outputs that we just had on the previous slide. So we can assume that the cloner is symmetric. We're going to analyze that possibility. We're also going to be interested, as we have been up to now, in the case where its fidelity is independent of the input state. So this in the literature is called a universal cloning machine. It's fidelity is state independent. And it turns out, if you think a little bit about the symmetries, that's quite a natural assumption and an easily justified one. If you have a machine that isn't universal, you can randomize. You can rotate your input state. You choose a random unitary, rotate your input state before you input it by their unitary u. Rotate your output states also by the inverse, u to the minus 1. And if your machine wasn't universal before, it will be after you do that. And with a little more thought, and I'm stating facts here rather than giving you complete proofs. It's not that hard to prove, but we're not going to do it on this slide here. With a little more thought, you can see not just that this trick gives you a universal cloner, even if you didn't have one, but it gives you one that's got complete rotational symmetry in the sense that the output states are have essentially the same form as the input states. They have the same block vector up to a scaling factor. So, I mean, very roughly speaking, the idea is, suppose you have an input A and the block vector is pointing in a different direction. Well, your randomization is going to average over all rotations about that, and so it's going to produce something that's actually aligned with A. Again, this is justifiable, but for the moment, I'm asking you to take that on trust. So now, accepting that, we have an input state that's a pure state, and two reduced density matrices, which are very simply related to that. The thing we're interested in is eta, a scaling factor, and what our cloning machine is essentially doing is taking up pure state and giving outputs mixed states that just shrink this block vector, move us from the boundary of the block sphere to somewhere in the interior of the block sphere. And the question is how large can we make eta? How little shrinking can we get away with? What's the fidelity? Well, you just need to take the trace of psi times rho I, and it drops out. It's half 1 plus eta. So it's a very simple linear function of eta. Are we happy with the project? Any questions so far? Okay, so our goal is to maximize eta. And the tool is subject to a constraint, and the constraint is going to come from the no signaling principle. So just to recap, our outputs are basically dirty copies of psi, shrunken copies in the Bloch sphere of psi. Okay, well, we have this very nice representation of single qubits in terms of the Pauli matrices, which we've been using here. So there's the input psi, there are the outputs. And I think I mentioned a couple of lectures ago, it's often the case if you have this, a problem with several qubits, that the easiest way to represent your states is to use the tensor product of bits. So in particular here, we have a two-qubit output state, and we could exploit the fact that you can write that any operator in four-dimensional space as a linear combination of identity, tensor identity, Pauli matrices, tensor identity, identity, tensor Pauli matrices, and Pauli matrices, tensor Pauli matrices. We're just using the fact that because the identity and the Pauli matrices are a basis of the one-qubit states, we can make a basis of two-qubit states just by taking the tensor products of each of those basis elements. So at the moment, what I've written down here is a general two-qubit state, modulo the fact that we know it's going to be produce reduced density matrices that have this shrinking effect by eta. So that's where I get this eta from. And I'm sorry, my notation slightly slid here. So this vector, the input vector was A, and I should write this M, this output vector, also as A, because we agreed that it's going to rescale the Bloch vector, but it's not going to change it. So what do we have to constrain this problem? Well, we have this principle of rotational invariance. And that's already going to give a non-trivial constraint. It must be whatever the input vector A is, the output vector has got to be a rotationally invariant function. The output vector. We have, and this is going to be the key thing, the no signaling principle. And we're going to use it just in the form we've already used it several times, looking at Herbert's flash scheme and why it doesn't work. So it must be the case that if you take a mixture of the outputs for the up and the down state, it's got to give you the same density matrix as if you take a mixture for the left and right. If you don't, then somebody can play the trick again of sharing a singlet with you, carrying out a measurement on their qubit of the singlet, either in the sigma z basis or the sigma x basis. And if these were different, then your approximate cloning machine would allow you to distinguish between those two measurement choices, and so would allow you to receive this superluminal signal. So we need that. You might think that we need, that there are more general forms of the no-signaling principle, and you'd be right. We could look at other measurements you could carry out, but it turns out that we can get all we need just from this particular one. And the third thing is, this has got to be a physical density matrix, this output. It's got, in particular, it's got to be non-negative. So all the eigenvalues have got to be equal to zero. Okay, so my promise, which I hope to fulfill on the next slide or two, is that just from this and this and this and this, we're going to get a tighter band. We're going to find the fidelity has to be less than 3/5. Okay, so let's start with rotational invariance. Keith, let's think in particular about the output if we input a Z up state. What do we know? Well, the output has got to be rotationally invariant about the Z axis. And if you remember, go back to when you played with rank 2 three-dimensional tensors. Well, that's really all we have here. We have something that's got to be rotationally invariant. So this thing, TJK, is a three-dimensional tensor that's rotationally invariant under rotation at the z-axis. And that tells you that anything that has one z component and one non-z component is going to have to vanish. And it also tells you, because I can rotate x into y, that the double x and the double y components have to be equal. And for the same reason, if I rotate x into y and you look at the form of the rotations, for instance, x to y sends y to minus x, that gives me that txy is minus tx. It's minus tyx. Sorry, there's a typo there. Okay. So this gives us already some quite non-trivial constraints on the form of this output. I have the identity term. I have the scaled term that gives us whatever approximation to cloning we're actually going to get. And then I have these terms involving two Pauli matrices. And then we now know that this coefficient has to be the same for both of these. Let's call it TXX. At the moment, we still have a different coefficient for sigma z cross sigma z. Call it TZZ. And we have a single coefficient, let's call it TXY, for this and this term for minus this one. And now if I add the two outputs from the case where I input spin up and spin down, about the z-axis, the terms that are linear in sigma z cancel. I get a minus sign for each of those. The xy terms also cancel. Again, I get the opposite term from the down state. And I just get contributions from the identity and from this and from this. These add up. So I just get factor of half and this term and this term and this term. Okay, so the outputs, the combination of outputs that we actually need for the no signaling argument is actually a relatively simple combination. And now we're in a position to apply the no signaling argument. We know that this combination has to be the same as this combination. And I move to the next screen. So this is the constraint we got from rotation invariance. This is still for spin z up and spin z down. And now we're going to apply the no signaling argument. Well, that gives me, I just really need to rotate z into x to see what I get here. I now get the same coefficient but multiplying sigma y tends to sigma y plus sigma z tends to sigma z. The two set combinations that aren't x instead of x and y. And here I get tzz x cross x instead of z cross z. So the only way that these two things can be equal is if I have full symmetry here. This coefficient has to equal this one, and this one, and this one. And then let's call it t. And then I have a single coefficient, t, multiplying a symmetric term, sigma x tends to sigma x, plus sigma y tends to sigma y, plus sigma z tends to sigma z. And the same thing here. Okay, so things have simplified further, and now we can go back to our output for spin up, which had this form, and replace the TXX and the TZZ terms by this single coefficient T. We still have the TXY term. We still, of course, have the scaling term. Okay, well, that's all we're going to get from no signaling. But now we have a reasonably simple combination in, of, that involves three unknown coefficients, eta, t, txy, and some products, some tensor products of Pauli matrices. And we just need to look at that thing and work out what its eigenvalues are. You can do that calculation. The eigenvalues turn out to be these combination, these linear combinations of eta and t, sorry, this linear combination of eta and t, and this combination of t and this square root. And the first constraint, since all of these have to be greater than or equal to zero, in particular the one with the minus sign has to be non-negative. That gives me that eta is less than or equal to t plus 1 over 2. The second constraint gives me some relation between t and txy. And to get eta as large as possible, I need to make t as large as possible. I get t as large as possible if this term is 0, the txy squared term is 0, in which case this becomes 2t is less than or equal to 1 minus t, so t is less than or equal to a third. If txy is non-zero, t gets to be smaller than a third, and so eta gets to be smaller. So I end up with txy equals 0, t equals a third, eta equals 2 thirds, and finally the thing we really care about, the fidelity, is 5/6. Yeah.
What is the least fidelity we need to be able to communicate supervolumen or something like that?
This calculation is supposed to have established exactly that. What we've shown by this argument is that if eta were greater than 5/6, we would be able to communicate superluminally. I have not yet shown that eta equals 5/6 or less than 5/6 does not allow superluminal communication. We still need to think about that. But we've got a bound from superluminal communication on eta. Is everybody? I'm not so worried whether you followed every last step of the algebra because you can easily work through that later. But is everybody clear about the overall logic of the argument here? We just basically have symmetry, no signaling principle, the need to have a physical output, in other words, a density matrix with non-negative eigenvalues. And from that we get a bound on eta. Yeah.
Is there some bigger meaning behind the 5/6?
It's
something that just pops out of the calculation, right? So.
What?
It's not a nice number.
It's not a nice number?
It's not something you would guess.
It's not. I agree. It's not something you would guess. I don't know how to answer that. Except first, we're going to see that you can achieve eta equals 5/6. So it's a. It's not just a bound, it's actually. Maybe the right way to answer that is this is the physical meaning of it. We've asked a new physical question, something that wasn't traditionally asked about quantum theory, and we find that it gives us new constants. Edson? I don't know. If the question is, can we relate it to some completely different question that didn't involve cloning? I'm not aware of any such relation. Okay, so we have a bound. Can we achieve the bound? Yes, and in fact, I'd slightly reverse the order of the history here. Historically, what happened was first that Buzek and Hilary raised this fascinating question of whether one can approximately clone, and gave an explicit construction of a cloner with fidelity 5/6. And it was only later proven that was in fact optimal. So again, there's a little bit of algebra in here. It's easy to verify. But let's just try and pick our way through it. Our cloning machine here actually is, it could be a single qubit. It's enough to describe its operations by states in two-dimensional space. And we're going to define its action first for two particular states, 0 and 1. We could spin up and spin down, if you like. And then notice, although it's not immediately obvious from the definition of those two states, that it does in fact work equally well for any input set. So psi plus is this particular combination 0 and 1. Here's our input 0, here's the reference state, here's the initial machine state. You could just play around experimentally, look for interesting things, see how what numbers you can put in and how close they get to approximation, how close they get to universality. And these are the numbers that Buzek and Hilary came up with, root 2/3, root 1/3, this particular combination psi plus. And magically, if you go through the algebra and then now look at what it does to a general state, let's call it psi, well, it turns out that it gives you, and this you need to just work through, it gives you psi and the orthogonal state minus a smaller multiple of psi, orthogonal state psi, and psi and the orthogonal state psi. It gives you something, in other words, that looks the same in any basis. If you go back to 0, you see psi per 0, you get psi perp minus root 1/3 times 1 over root 2, so root 1/6, psi perp, psi, and again a root 1/6, psi perp, psi. That's for psi equals 0. But magically, with this definition, it's actually the same for any input state psi. It's always this combination. And if you look at the fidelity, look at the first state and the reduced density matrix for the first qubit, we have a contribution from this one of 2/3, and a contribution from this one of 1/6, and then 0 from the last one because it's the orthogonal state. So we end up with 2/3 plus 1/6. We end up with 5/6. So that's intriguing. As presented, it's just a little bit of algebraic magic, but it's at least satisfying that we've been able to achieve the no signaling mount by what turned out to be a very simple construction. Why does it work? Well, as I say, you could think of it just as you can arrive at it just by exploring, just by doing sort of experimental mathematics and trying to find things that work. But to understand it more deeply, you need a little more sophistication. But there is a deeper way of understanding this as the simplest case of a much larger class of optimal universal cloning machines. That includes not just qubit cloning, but cloning in arbitrary dimensions, and includes not just the problem of making two approximate copies from one state, but any number of approximate copies from any number of input states. It takes rather more work than we're going to have time for here to justify all of this, but if you're interested in exploring the literature, maybe writing an essay or reviewing it, it would not at all be a bad topic to explore further. And there's a very nice review paper by Skarani and three other authors, which summarizes very well and rather appealingly a lot of literature on this. There are also a couple of key papers by Carlo Werner and Werner that describe this construction. So I'll almost leave it there, except to make a comment. We did better than our brain-dead schemes. Our brain-dead schemes gave us 2/3 and 3/4. In the end, we saw that the bound of 5/6 is attainable. We did better, but it's not enormously better. 5/6 isn't all that much bigger than 3/4. And that turns out to be generally, roughly speaking loosely, the case. You can do a little bit better with clever cloning schemes, with optimal cloning schemes, than you can with pretty trivial strategies involving just adding further random states to symmetrizing. You do a little bit better, but not actually all that much better. Very, very roughly, the intuition is you've got an unknown state that carries a certain amount of information, and then there's only really approximately one state's worth of information there to be had, and you can play around with it however you like, but you're not going to do much better than just keeping that original state and adding random extra stuff. And then, depending on how you look at it, that's good or it's bad. If your quantum states are resources and you really want to back them up to make redundant copies, as you might, for instance, in the quantum computation, this is very bad news. This is telling you that approximate cloning is not really going to help you to any significant extent. You have one unknown state, you'd really like to be able to make at least several pretty good approximate copies of it, so that if you lose one of them, because the machine fails, or because noise affects it, you can replace that copy. You're in deep trouble. So that's a disappointment. On the other hand, it's extremely good news if your objective is to make sure that the states can't be copied. If you're interested in using quantum states for cryptography, it's excellent news that whatever somebody does to an unknown state that you fed in somewhere, they're not going to be able to make very much progress at all in trying to run off extra copies of that state. Yeah?
I have a question on how to think about it. So if you have, say, fidelity 5 over 6,
mm-hmm.
So if you have some quantum state and you copy it, you get 5 over 6. So does it mean there's probability 5 out of 6 that I'll get the correct state? Or will it be a state that's correct up to 5 parts in 6? So in a way, if I have a long transmission and I copy all of it, I get 5 out of 6 roughly for the transmission.
If I copy it many times,
will I get 5 out of 6 randomly? So could I copy the state many times and try to get something that statistically brings me to one?
No. We're producing... We're not producing a pure state as the output. Our input is a pure state. It's going into the machine, and so is our reference state, whatever it is. That sets that one. So these are both going into the machine. And we're producing, well, in general, actually, we're producing a triply entangled state of this output in the machine. But in particular, the reduced density matrices for these two outputs are both mixed states. So it would just be incorrect to say, with probability 5/6, I've reproduced the input state either.
What I've
produced is a mixed state that is reasonably close to it on the block sphere. So there is a correct statement involving the words probability 5/6, and that is, if I test this state, if I carry out a measurement of the projection onto the original state, will I get the answer yes? Yes, I will get the answer yes with probability 5/6, because that's how we define the fidelity. But of course, well, that's mathematically true. To be able to do this, you need to know the state psi itself. Otherwise, this fact isn't immediately.
So you can't get any sort of probability without knowing the psi.
Well, that's maybe not phrased precisely enough for me to say yes or no. It's not correct to say that there's any non-zero probability. With any non-zero probability, you have produced two copies of your unknown state. So,
I'm just thinking that, I mean, if you produce a copy, and say someone has sent a message to someone encoded by qubits, I mean, say some spin ups and spin downs, they know how to decrypt it. And then I copy this transmission, and and I make those, I make many copies of that.
So you run it, okay, copy, you run it through your approximate cloning machine.
And I run it through the approximation machine many times.
What input is on the second machine?
What the indeed, what's the input in the second machine?
The original.
You've already lost the input. You could input the output, one of the outputs from your first machine, but that's already a degraded copy, and it's going to produce something even more degraded the second time.
But
yeah.
So what about if I make a measurement on the state?
On the output state?
On the output state, yeah. What kind of, I guess 5/6 of that measurement would match the measurement.
If you know or just randomly guess what the input state was and carry out the measurement of this projection onto the input state, then with probably 5/6 you'll get the answer yes.
But
given that you, our original assumption was that you don't know what the input is,
yeah.
This isn't very useful information to you because you don't know what measurement to carry out to do this.
Right.
But it might be useful information to somebody else who did know what input was.
So some arbitrary measurement.
So you choose, suppose you make a random measurement on the output.
Pardon?
It's the idea that you just choose a random measurement and apply that to the output.
Yeah. Had I made that random measurement on the input state, how is that going to match 5/6 of the time the result of that measurement?
I guess not, but you could do that. You could do that calculation.
Right. I was wondering if it's just going to be the trace over the
Can I do it in my head?
Yeah.
I probably want to go with, but I think it would be rather worse than 5/6.
Okay. I just wasn't sure if it was obvious that it was exactly 5/6, and since it's not, you're probably right.
I'm pretty sure it's not. Let me just check the time. How are we doing?
I guess we started.
We started a bit late. So I can run on for a few more minutes, probably.
Okay.
So those questions actually lead nicely into what I wanted to talk about next, which is an idea that really was produced right at the start of interest in quantum information by Stephen Wiesner. And it's an interesting story because he wrote a paper on suggesting applications of quantum theory to cryptography, submitted it to a journal. Presumably the editors looked at it and thought, quantum theory, cryptography, these don't really have anything to do with each other. This looks a bit crazy, we've never heard of this guy. So it was rejected. And he was rather discouraged by that. And it wasn't until Charlie Bennett, and I think Charlie Bennett in particular, picked up on the idea. Over a decade later, the Wiesner manuscript was eventually published. So we're getting a sense here of quantum states as things that carry information, and information that has different properties from classical information, from the information we're more familiar with. And the no-cloning theorem is a fairly dramatic example of that. If I give you a bit, a 0 or a 1, you can make as many copies as you like. If I give you a letter, you can put it through a Xerox and run off as many copies as you like. And there may be issues with fidelity, but there's no physical bound on how faithfully you can copy the information. So Wiesner's idea was to use the uncopyability of quantum information to give greater security, in fact, to give perfect security for particular cryptographic tasks. And one of his examples was quantum money. I think he originally phrased it as unforgeable subwave tokens, but we can think of it as a scheme for money. So here's the idea. We have a central bank that is able to create banknotes that incorporate little storage devices that incorporate quantum states. Let's say they're encoded as qubits and there's n of them. And the bank makes each banknote with a classically distinct record number, as is currently the case. And for each classically distinct record number, they make a different sequence of quantum states in the qubits. And they keep in their vaults a complete record of all the record numbers. And these are now classical records of the qubits they prepared. So they know they prepared a qubit with spin along this axis. They've written down exactly what that axis is here, and similarly for each qubit. And the next banknote has a different serial number and a different set of qubits classically recorded in the bank's central vault. And all of these things are out there circulating in the real world, carrying their qubits around. So the idea is that any time the bank suspects a banknote of being a forgery, it can pull it in, look at its records, say, aha, it's supposed to have this series of qubits here, and carry out the appropriate measurements. So it will measure the first qubit, looking at the projection onto this state and see whether it gets the answer yes. The second one onto this one, see if it gets the answer yes, and so on. The bank has a way of testing the validity of each of these quantum banknotes. So the task of a forger, obviously, is to try and generate from one banknote in their hand two or more banknotes that will pass the bank's tests, two or more banknotes that won't be detectable as forgeries. But to do that, while we assume they have good printing technology, we assume that it can deal with all the classical information, they can certainly copy the serial number. But to do that, they also have to copy the quantum states, or clone the quantum states, or at least approximately, to good approximation, clone the quantum states. And here, their problem is multiplied by n. They have n unknown qubits. They have to produce two banknotes, each of which has an approximate clone of each of the n qubits. And we've just seen that for any given qubit, the forger is going to succeed in that, in the sense that both banknotes will pass the bank's tests with probability no more than 5/6. So if n is large, the probability of overall success is no more than 5/6 to the n. In other words, if we take n large enough, we can make their probability of success as small as we like. And we have, asymptotically at least, essentially perfect security for this banknote scheme. It's an old idea now, but I still think it's a very beautiful idea. And there's still a lot of research on variations of quantum money and different things you can achieve. It's not, at this moment in time, it is not very, very practically feasible because we have even in the laboratory, no way of storing qubits for the long term, let alone in banknotes. So you have to have a certain sort of blue skies perspective about some of these applications, in particular this one. But one day it will happen. I don't know when. But one day I think we'll all be carrying quantum banknotes around. Any more questions or comments on this? Yeah.
And what happens if somebody measures it, randomly or something like that? Then the whole data would be managed?
Yeah, you better not let people measure the qubits in your banknotes. Absolutely. you better take good care of them. Yeah, that's right. So these things have to be stored in such a way that they're very well isolated from the environment and from maybe malicious people who just want to go around vandalizing by waving devices over your wallet and destroying your banknote. This is true. That's a good point. Yeah.
I think the problem is not the probability, but if you want to have a copy of money, and you have to ruin this money is state, and then you can't get even though you can get the copy then if you only have one copy and there is no use for copy money because you only get one transaction.
Well, remember what we've been looking at is a scheme in which you input one unknown state and you get two outputs, which are admittedly not perfect copies, but somewhat dirty copies of the input state. So if we could get the fidelity arbitrarily close to one, we would indeed be able to generate, you'd be able to basically input one banknote and get two banknotes that very likely will pass the test out. So it is crucial that we have this bound that's separated from one, this bound of 5-6. More questions?
So if we copy twice, did we get, in some sense, the original state?
Again, what does this mean, copy twice? We input...
We input one state and then
into
we get
into
two
the
states which are...
We get two dirty outputs.
Yeah, two dirty outputs.
And now we input one of those outputs into the machine again?
Yeah. It's passive or it's not undirty. So
No, you'll get dirtier. You'll get two even dirtier outputs. But try it. Verify that for yourself. More thoughts, comments, questions? Okay, so let's wrap up for today. And we meet again at 1:30 tomorrow.